It's very much a pleasure to be here tonight with you and to have heard about some of the things going on in Willits. Sort of practicing weapons of mass construction, you might say. Basically, I'm bringing to you a message from Portland. And what we're talking about, we think is worth talking about because we're basically talking about you too. Challenges that all communities face and the opportunities, therefore, are challenges and opportunities that we all share. The forms will change every single time according to every combination of people that's involved together. But what you'll find that I'm going to be showing you tonight is going to be basically about restoring participation, talking about what people can create together when they decide to focus together on creating common ground. So in order to talk about city repair tonight and therefore talk about sustainable culture, I'm going to be talking a lot about unsustainable culture. Therefore, we'll be talking about globalization a bit and colonialism, how that's affected not only the landscape we live in, but it's affected our entire stream of the development of our culture or the civilization that we live in. One thing that city repair likes to point out is that culture is different than civilization. Civilization has to do with civil structures. It has to do with the ancient concept of the civis from the Latins that were very aggressive, that basically formed the Roman culture. Civilization is a process that's synonymous with colonialism. It has to do with going into where people live in indomitable cultures and changing their cultural patterns, basically disempowering them and putting them into a civic structure where they become citizens of the city-state. Oftentimes when we talk about like civilization or citizens or civic participation, we don't really realize quite what we're talking about because, for one thing, the knowledge that our villages were taken away from us has been obscured from the record. And yet we are all villagers. All the values that we have that impel us from deep inside to create patterns of connection, all of the cultural expressions that we have, the languages that we speak, the songs that we sing, like all of those things arose within the sort of context of village cultures. And on the other hand, the city-state does not tend to create things. It tends to evolve technology. It tends to make people be specialists as opposed to generalists. And it's all about competing and dividing and compartmentalizing people and making them work their whole freaking life and wonder why they're even there. Like, why are we here? Like, what a question. I mean, you notice that when you're really enjoying yourself, you don't tend to ask questions like that. So I'm speaking on behalf of the City Repair Project and Communitecture, two organizations, cultures really. I mean, sometimes people use the word volunteers in our projects, but I don't like that at all because the main thing that we're trying to build is relationships. So I don't like to relate to anybody in terms of a hierarchy or in terms of an authority or someone being a volunteer per se. It's about becoming friends again and reintegrating what has been disintegrated. So a lot of people talk when they're looking at what city repair does, they say, geez, you guys seem to be planners. Are you anthropologists? You're natural builders. You're doing permaculture. Are you architects? Don't seem to quite be architects because you seem to be doing more carcitecture than architecture. As you'll see tonight, we do some bizarre things that roll. So actually, we think of ourselves as being more like economists. Like we say, okay, economics is about the house, right? Eco, that's about the house. So as economists, we also say, well, the economy is really about the ecology because that's about the house too. So what we do in city repair as creative economists, you might say, is that we say, all right, well, economics is supposed to consist of three things: social capital, natural capital, and economic capital. And at best, it's a tripod of three equally balanced things that all fit together into a balanced whole. Okay, but in the paradigm that we're in, just to understand the economy and why it's constantly needing to grow, because it's an empire model that constantly needs to be expanding and assimilating the stuff, the lives of other people. The way that that economy works is that the social capital is very narrowly focused into the lives or into the hands of a few people. The economic emphasis is massive. That has to do with the monetary structure. And then the natural capital is really only accessed by them to be exploited. So one thing that we're talking about when we're talking about sustainable culture is a rebalancing of the three parts of economy and a total first emphasis on relationships. Because as soon as you activate social capital, what we mean by friendship and love and family and community, everything else starts to work, because once you have relationships and reintegrated community, things start to flow. The natural capital, the economic capital becomes accessible, and the best ideas come to the fore. And that is what we always meant by democracy. Yes, there'll be a test. Okay, so we do permaculture, we do natural building, we do ecological design. But Penny Livingston, who's sort of a permaculture goddess, said of city repair lately that city repair is the application of the principles of permaculture to human consciousness. It begins by stating outwardly that human beings have a habitat. We have a habitat. And because we're villagers, chances are it's the village. One of the things we'll be talking about tonight as we're talking about solutions is we'll be pointing out that what happened to our ancestors that caused us to lose our villages, when they were conquered, chances are in those villages they held land in common, they tracked time in terms of cycles, and then they had an indomitable sense of culture. As soon as they're conquered, the land becomes compartmentalized. It becomes a commodity. Time becomes measured with a linear sort of emphasis, with a certain beginning and a certain ending, and the whole story described in between, as you know what I'm talking about. And then community becomes divided against itself, where all the cooperation of the inherent cooperation of the society gets turned inside out into competitive models. What city repair does is just say, we're starting over again, and we're going to just set those things in proper relation and model all of those things and give people a chance to feel what it's like to be in a landscape that is common and where time seems to be endless and in which community is in cooperation. And then the creativity just sort of takes everything from there. So I just want to point out a few things that I was thinking about on the way up here besides the idea of weapons of mass construction. I want to point out, like, when we talk about basketball players being dominant, like Jordan's dominant, we don't really, again, know what we're saying. Think about these words. Dominance comes, again, from the Latins, those colonizers that came down from the north into the lands of Rome. They called God Dominus, just as they called the landlord in Roman times Dominus. The model of the God King was there. Dominus dominated the domain. He had a domicile that was served by the minions. Those would be our ancestors. Architecture itself, this is going to sound confusing for a moment, is the material fabric of dominance. Now, I'm not saying that we shouldn't have roofs over our head or community structures, absolutely. But look at the word architecture again that comes to us from Latin. It means structure and technology. A Native American can point out to you that it doesn't connotate anything about home or people or culture. And in fact, the object emphasis within the practice of architecture and planning as we know it is inherently antithetical to sustainable culture, because it precludes from the beginning participation of the people who will live in the buildings, unless you happen to be designing your own home, in which case it's not quite architecture in the same sense. So I want to ask, when did the situation arise that we work for someone else rather than with each other? And when will come the time, and when will be the place, where will be the place when we live together again? Some people talk about how someday we may have world peace. Maybe it'll be the next generation, because we have a sense of progress now. But I know this, someday someone's going to say, right now. My friend Pedro Ferbel in Portland says this. He's an anthropologist that works with city repair. And he says, it is time for us to stop trying to convince each other that something is wrong. Like, you hear it in coffee houses, you hear it around the dinner table. Did you hear about the latest atrocity? You know, and then just kind of trying to convince each other to instill yet another sort of level of awareness about what's happening, what's going wrong. Pedro says it's really time to stop trying to convince each other and just move. Movement. In City Repair, we say revolution happens all the time, and it's about the cycles of time, how things just happen from day to day. We just make our choices, they all add up, something happens, and the revolution just keeps turning and turning. Eventually it pops, things turn over. Now the way that in colonial structures revolutions happened in the past is that everything has fallen apart and a lot of people have been hurt. But because we are a creative culture and we have an opportunity, a really important opportunity now at this time in our story, we have an opportunity to create a new vision and to lead the way to something that isn't quite the same form of revolution anymore. So with that, I'd like to just start. Okay, this story starts with just reminding you that moving through time and space, whether it was crossing the oceans to come to this land or moving across this land, you know, moving westward, a lot of seriously bad things happened to the people who lived here before, and that's the central part of the story. But another thread in the fabric of that story is that people moving across that land were running from something and running to something like the promised land. They were looking for a new beginning. They were looking for a place for their family and their community. They were trying to find somewhere that had water, that had open space, that had material abundance, a quality of light, and a sense of place where they felt like, once again, they could rejoin with their sense of the Creator. And that's the story of everyone. Like, whether you're looking for a new apartment or trying to start an eco-village outside of town because you can't stand the civic condition, like, the idea of uprooting and restarting is all about searching for a sense of place. A sense of place is about where things are in balance, all about social, natural, and economic capital. Let's look at the village for a second, because we'll be talking a lot about villages tonight, and let's look at the city-state. This is Perugia. This is an Italian village. Thousands, millions of Americans go across the ocean every year to visit cultures. Then they come back home, and then they go back to work. When they go to Perugia, or any other hill town, or places in Africa, they'll notice that people are out in the streets. They're not asking whose streets. The people that are down in the streets, they tend to live up here, and then they tend to own the shops down here. They come outside, their children go across the street to get bread, they get flowers, and as they're moving through the streets, all these generations, they tend to meet other people that they might fall in love with. As they move through the fabric of the village, they move from one piazza or place, like a tide, moving through the streets, to the next piazza or place, and then they move to the next one, and it happens all day long, and they never have to talk about building community because it was built in the beginning as a reflection of their ancestors' vision, honoring the pathways that they had always trod as they walked to the water source. Okay, so it's all about the buildings defining the sense of place and the whole space being given over to people. Cars still get into here, but they drive slowly because they have relationships with the people in the street and they care. All right, so that's Perugia. And this is, it doesn't really matter, does it? I mean, where it is. It could be anywhere. The main thing is the people are not where they live. This is noon. This is noon. Lunchtime? Lunchtime. Except these folks are everywhere else but where they live. Who made the choice to design a place and an economic structure and a set of zoning regulations that would make it so the people who lived here would not be at home at noon, they'd be off all everywhere else but here. And when they came home at the end of the day after working with people that they never quite get to know because it's all about work, they come back to a place where they never quite get to know these people by and large because there is no sort of creative opportunity or even any functional common ground. Some people, when they look at this image, they say, oh, come on, really? This is a car city. Get with it. All right, but it's really important to realize, and kind of chilling, that to realize that this was laid out before cars even existed. So what up? Where did this thing come from? Like, why? Who decided that there would be a setback from the sidewalk to the face of the buildings and that they would all stand at attention as if they were regimented? Who decided that the sidewalks and the entire landscape would be utterly linear, that there would be this no-person zone where you couldn't really do anything except perhaps garden and then this streetscape and then the whole structure reflected over there? Why was this all decided in the stroke of a pen in 1785 for everything west of the Ohio River all the way to the Pacific Ocean, and we didn't know about it until just now? Called the National Land Ordinance. So this is a village. It looks like a string of pearls. It's one of the most indomitable landscapes in the world. You're looking at Mali, a Dogon village. This is, of course, the colonial grid that was blueprinted in 1785 from Roman colonialism. Some people think that it was invented by Thomas Jefferson, because you're told in high school it's the Jeffersonian grid. It's democratic because it's all the same. Well, just remember this. Empires are all about homogenizing people, even as they tell them, even as they're being told that they're free and that they're individuals. It's all about individuating and yet homogenizing. This has a lot in common, though, with this. I should say, though, it's not just that it wasn't Thomas Jefferson's invention. The Spanish and the Portuguese were using it all throughout Central, South America, and Mexico, as a lot of people here know. But it's not even from the Romans. It comes from the Assyrians 5,000 years ago, and it was first formed as a detention camp. Then it went to Babylonia, then it went to Egypt, then it went to Greece, then Rome. Then the French used it for a while. And then finally it started to be used again in the so-called Americas. So one thing that the Assyrians liked about it, and also the police force like about it now, is that they can post someone here, and because they've flattened the landscape, as far as they can see down any street, they can see any activity that's happening. You can just post sentries diagonally across the way and maintain domestic control. Okay, but that's the grid. On the other hand, here's a village, and they have a lot in common, believe it or not. There are blocks, as you can see. Here's a block. There's a cellular structure here. There are pathways, and they lead to intersections, just like over here. But because these people are truly free, and they're the ones driving their landscape, making decisions together, not a bunch of planners downtown or the Continental Congress 200 years ago. Check this out. Here's the block, and in the center of the block, an opening is made so that people can come outside and experience the commons just as they move throughout the day. The commons. So they never have to ask, like, hey, let's find some common ground here. I mean, we're having some problems. Let's find some common ground. It's all over the place. So they come out into the commons of the paths that lead to the intersections where the markets happen, the celebrations, all cultural activities at the village scale, and they're all over the village. So it holds the whole village together, and this is all about culture and communication, because culture depends upon communication, as opposed to this, which is a traffic corridor that people only move through, and then, of course, on the block level, by law and reinforced by insurance programs, it can't happen. Like, why would anyone choose to do this? I wonder why. Okay, going back to the beginning of intersections, let's just look at how they're supposed to work. Urban planners call an intersection a node, where the pathways converge. In the grid, it doesn't tend to get to be a node because nothing tends to happen there. And it's literally the difference between to be and not to be. Like in the village, the answer to the intersection is to be, because the culture is saying to be. And in the grid, the answer is not to be, because the culture is being designed out of the landscape because we're supposed to be working, right? Well, in Africa, this aerial view of a watering hole, you can see all these pathways of people and animals leading out in the savanna to this watering hole. The animals and the people kind of stomp around because they're lingering around here. So this is a great intersection. They're coming to the source. Well, the Egyptians took that relationship, just like a lot of other cultures around the world, and talked about the four directions, the convergence of pathways, and they turned it into their hieroglyph for city. It's a place diagram of how we just instinctively, automatically move. We travel pathways, our pathways cross, we bump into each other, things happen. That's the principle of the African deity Elegua, the idea that things happen when pathways overlap. So when we look at sustainable cultures, oftentimes we find they tend to meet in circles. They're all about common ground, cultural expression. And they oftentimes have these symbols that talk about the order of the world, like the axis of rotation, and then the direction of rotation, the north, south, east, west, and then the great circle of time, or the circle of the world, the seasons that pass in four quarters. So it's about an integrated view of time and space. And then this piece of amber at the center, this is the Mayan mandala of the tree of life. This piece of amber at the center is talking about the blood of the tree. where individuals, communities come together with the transcendent. Everything is integrated. So it's a holistic vision. And the utility of the symbol that they're all agreeing upon as being their most sacred symbol is about them being in relationship with the whole of existence. So that's about sustainable culture, totally. Okay, and then cultures, this is a civil war here on the left. Cultures that don't tend to have symbols that teach them about their agreed upon relationship to time and space tend, as we know, to sort of exist in a constant condition of strife. This symbol, a lot of people don't really understand this with a historical view, but really all you have to do is look at the colonial story of the Romans. This stump that he's nailed to is referencing the tree of life. Okay, we know that much. But the tree of life in an indigenous culture is talking about the whole of the material reality, all the animals, all the people existing there together, in these cycles of death and rebirth, living and dying. But this one is as Joseph Campbell pointed out, it's concretized. It's overlaying this tree of life symbol with an individual. And for the Romans, it was very handy. They adopted this symbol as the symbol for their state religion in the 4th century AD. And what they really liked about it, besides concretizing the symbol and making it about one rather than everyone, it was talking about the next life. Because you were supposed to put up with this life, you know, so it's about like the next life. If you can just survive this one, you get to the next one. But as you already know, the Romans were all about crucifying people. They crucified the army of Spartacus all the way to the gates of Rome. Thousands and thousands of people that stood up to power, and then they were turned into examples. So what the Romans really liked about this symbol was it was also saying nobody stands up to power, not even God. Next. Okay, but this is familiar stuff. That should not be a shock. After all, December 25th is the birthday of Hercules, it turns out. Or Mars, or Attis, or any number of Mediterranean pagan saviors. Of course, you know, this is a consistent pattern with empire. They go out, they invert people's understanding, not only of time and space, but of their mythology and of their own story. You know, like Native Americans' language and rituals were outlawed. Same gig happened to our ancestors. And here's something that many people don't know. The tallest mountain in the world is actually called Chomo Lung Ma on one side and Saga Marta on the other side of the mountain. In two different languages, they both translate to mean Mother Goddess of the Universe. And even the British climbers that are within 100 miles of this are calling it Chomo Lung Ma, not George Everest, sorry ass colonizer. Okay, well, looking at Portland, how it used to be, and then what it has recently become, it's a good thing to ask ourselves, how did we get from here to here? How did we go from this inter-woven network of villages and pathways, ancestral pathways and sacred places, and this free-flowing like vein of life that moved through the valley to this gridwork of 96 neighborhoods without even one single public square in any neighborhood, despite the fact that there's probably about 150 different ethnicities, all of whom came from villages. What is going on? You can ask the same question of anywhere in virtually in North America. Okay, but we're villagers, right? I mean, did anyone ever stand up and say, I mean, I know that none of my ancestors and none of your ancestors ever stood up and said, hey, I have got a great idea. How about if we just get rid of all the public squares right in the middle of where we live? We don't need them anyway. I mean, we just got a lot of work to do. Let's have a vote. Like, that never, ever happened. Okay, but whether you're from England or Ethiopia or France or Polynesia, we come from villages. You know, southern Germany, a little village here, about a third the size of a Portland neighborhood, 12 outdoor public gathering plots is 10 times less crime. The Lakota Sioux, moving across the plains, dragging their teepees behind them on their horses, come to water, form a circle, the great intersection of the village. It's a human pattern. We all do it. So just looking at intersections for a second, again, the village and the city. Here's Siena, the Piazza del Campo that began as a great meadow where the pathways between Pisa, Milan, and Rome all met at a great mountain meadow, great concave shell-shaped meadow. They honored and respected that great gathering place over time and just built the fabric of the village up around it. on the floor of this great piazza, there are 9 pie wedges, sort of graphically installed in different colors of brick. Those 9 pie wedges correspond to the 9 neighborhoods, or rather, contradas, out in the fabric of the village. And each one of those 9 contradas have a major piazza and then sub-piazzas around them. So the diagram of the village is about, you know, everything adding up at the center and connecting everyone to the center. Those 9 contradas have a horse race twice a year. Each contrada gets to have a horse, and they run twice around the piazza. And then the winner, what do they get to do? They carry the beautiful piece of art, it's a flag, through the streets of this Gothic village, singing songs about culture and community for the next few months until the next horse race. You know, the sounds reverberating off of the walls. And like, they've been doing this a long, long time. They choose to do this to celebrate themselves. Okay, so there's the idea of the intersection to be a place, and the intersection not to be a place that you just sort of pass through as you're seeking another place. You know, like there are the signs, go to Estacada. You know, eventually you'll find a street name, and then you'll find your house. You know, but there won't be a place in Estacada either. Okay, well, the paradigm shift happens like this, and it's kind of like, it's almost like you can trace it in the geometry. The circle, as we know from Native Americans, where they sit in teepees and sing together, seeing each other in the face, like speaking their truth, being heard, celebrating, being married, falling in love. Like, that's what these Celtic people did in this circle, where they could see each other, you know, and participate. As opposed to that, then the Romans come in, wham! Destroy the sacred space and immediately overlay it with the new paradigm. And it's not just that it's linear, it's that one official voice speaks from the official manual of truth, and everyone just sits in rows, listening, and falling asleep a lot of the time, because they're not participating, and it's not about their participation. So, paradigm shifts, square over circle. Okay, so the city-state is basically this diagram. A concentration of wealth and authority at the center, we tend to call that downtown, and then out in the outlying area, in the grid work, where the workers live, there don't tend to be places for convergence, they're all just eliminated. And then this is the administrative center, located on the waterway, that oversees the way that the rest of the landscape is basically used. So this is the model of the Roman colonial grid that was adopted for the National Land Ordinance. And it wasn't just adopting the geography, it was adopting the economic structure, the political structure, and virtually even dictated our moral values. And it was very much about patriarchy, the idea that, you know, at the most local level, the landlord's identity of one individuated person overlays the people who live on the land that they own. The mayor's face overlays the city, the governor's face overlays the state, the president's face overlays the nation, the Pope's face overlays, you know, this whole other body of people. And then the idea of the conception of God overlays the world. So it's the conception of the God-King concentrating and individuating a whole identity because things have been inverted and turning the entire fabric of reality into something that can be numerically interchanged. We basically play this game when we play Monopoly. And, of course, the point of Monopoly is to concentrate power and authority so that eventually everyone else is off the board and one person owns everything. That's the game. Okay, well, you should be really pissed off about that, especially when you look at what is being done to our mother. Feedlot, housing lot, Manhattan. Manhattan began, after the indigenous people were sort of removed from the landscape there, it began with all these agricultural uses. There were orchards and animals. Things were gridded off like this. Eventually, houses were built. It began to densify and densify and densify and densify. As we know, things work in our civilization. But the thing to really feel about here is that whether you're fattening cattle or you're housing people, we're calling the world a lot. It's a lot system. It's broken up into lots. And from the beginning, it's to be about a commodity that just sort of changes over time. And whatever used to be sacred here will not remain. Whether people made love, whether they had children, whether they rose up or what have you, it's just about this thing that just goes on and obscures beauty. It obscures resistance. I totally want to celebrate cultures of resistance, of which everyone in this room is a part. because after all, we are still here. But I also want to point out, too, that in spite of these structures that overlay us, we are incredible beings. And as everyone in this room knows, we are beautiful and we are indomitable after all. We have to count on that. If we're going to have a sustainable future, we do things to make the world beautiful. We keep trying to understand and keep connecting. Like, we are problem solvers that were designed, hardwired to deal with the situation that we're in right now. We have evolved this way. You know, whether you hold one kind of view of how we've gotten here or another kind of view, maybe evolutionary as opposed to religious, like, we've been all about problem solving and being indomitable the whole time. Well, when I got out of architecture school, I wanted to go look at these societies and these aspects of architecture that I'd been learning about in school, but I didn't really realize that there's a difference between studying the Greeks and Romans in drawings and actually going to see the lands that the Greeks and Romans occupied. So I went to see Greco-Roman architecture. When I got to the island of Delos, I was like, man, like, those are beautiful little fragments, but the buildings are totally wiped out. And of course, you know, the people are gone. This is a totally unsustainable situation. And check out the fact that the topsoil is gone, and the animals are gone, and the trees are gone. What happened here? I didn't really understand colonialism at the time, but the Greeks were very aggressive colonizing culture, and they brought their own destruction upon themselves because of how they were behaving, as did the Romans. And as we know now, the bigger they are, the harder they fall. Fortunately, we have the world around us to see how the goddess built. Okay, a lot of things were happening in Portland at the time, and there's a whole litany of things that I can talk about that are just expanding and expanding in every dimension of the culture. But two of the most important things to mention are that KBOO 90.7 Community Radio started up at that time and activated the airwaves, activated the electronic commons, and expanded a dialogue that had only been happening in a small scale, and it led to all kinds of change. They just kept moving the boundaries outward, and the mainstream culture just fell into the void and started to shift and do all of these things, like create the only elected regional government in the country that oversees urban growth boundaries, acquisition of green spaces and wetlands, and all kinds of other important things like recycling programs. 87% of people in Portland are recycling. Okay, People's Food Cooperative started up and started local farmers markets, talking about all kinds of options and giving people real options and also opportunities to interact with each other in ways they hadn't been able to before. What's really important to point out about those kinds of projects that you guys are doing here too is that it expands the conversation, and people start noticing, even if they're not participating, things start to shift because you've shifted the field of consciousness. So in Portland, whether people are planting corn, permaculture gardens in their yards, or the larger community of governments in the region have agreed upon, like, urban growth boundaries and concentrating growth on major traffic arterials and reinvigorating downtown, things across the spectrum have been shifting at a very fast pace and changing. Okay, but the problem with this kind of diagram is that it still does not prioritize the growth of local culture or the restoration of the gathering places of our ancestors to the places where we live, which is why city repair has arisen. So we call city repair, you know, we say that it's about the restoration of communication, citizen participation in public squares, but really it's about something deeper than that. And we don't happen to believe that cities can be repaired. We think that villages need to be restored. Village culture needs to have a chance to root again. This poster from Earth Day 2001 sort of tells the story. We're just talking about giving people a chance. You know, people have to leave where they live to go do their stuff, whether it's selling things or growing things or making things or celebrating. They all have to go to other venues and places. What we're saying is restore the node in the midst of where people live. Enable them to know each other so that they can start to create these things together and see what happens. So we look at how people live in the city-state now. Say this is a mother, and this is a diagram of unsustainability as opposed to one about sustainability. These are called travel and communication diagrams that we use in urban design. So here's a woman, and she gets in her car at the beginning of the day, and she goes all the way to North Portland, and she gets into a truck. She's a roofer. She crosses over to Northwest Portland to go fix a roof with the company she works for. At the end of the day, she comes back, she gets in her car, comes home, buys some food, runs downtown, comes home, picks up her child, goes to the Health Sciences Center, comes back, and that's only part of her day. And everyone else in the city is moving all over the infrastructure, doing all kinds of things that they might be doing differently. Like, for instance, right next door to her was a roof that needed repair. Right next door to her was an educator. Right next door to her, things were being grown and things were being made. But would she know it? So we're talking about enabling people to have this kind of relationship as the genesis diagram for overall sustainable culture change. Seems difficult, seems hard, doesn't it? Well, let's just see what happens. This is going to be chronological, and it's going to start with projects that you can do with the money that's in your own pocket right now that leads to exponential change. Okay, and we're going to go from the smallest doable things to the largest things that involve thousands of people. Okay, the first thing that we did in city repair is we said, okay, meeting houses are missing everywhere where people live. Free meeting houses where basically we can practice freedom of assembly in a place. So we looked at the fact that a lot of people living in the Selwood neighborhood where we began this project had Celtic ancestry. So we said, okay, let's look at a Celtic model. Let's look at some other indigenous Native American models, like the kinds of meeting places that they use in the rainforest where Mayan people live now, and see what happens if we can kind of create that sort of architecture and enable a social ritual which is totally unprogrammed. So the first thing we did was we built what was called the Moonday Tea House. It happened every Monday night. It was basically a big potluck sharing event. It was about 900 square feet. It was woven into a living garden with conifers, pear trees, cherry trees, rhododendrons, and it was built out of 10 separate rooms that were all fit together like a puzzle. Part of why we did this was because a Native American roadman, I don't know if you know about roadmen, but Native American communities have been sending roadmen into cities to interrupt people's experiences, to speak with people and challenge their ideas. So this man named Elk River, he was a Cheyenne roadman, came into Selwood. He started to have conversations with people. He appeared to be a homeless man. And he said things like, you know, if you guys really want to change something, you have to start looking at the lines drawn all around you and ask yourself, who drew those lines? And what kind of relationship do you have to them? How is it affecting your family? You know, you're all divided in this way. And we didn't even know what he was talking about. We didn't really want to hear any more of it. But he said, those lines are containing you. If you want to make change happen, simply walk across the line. It works like this. Cross the line. You become an intersection, and you engage whoever created that line to come in and deal with the fact that you've crossed the line. He said, you don't have any places to meet. Why don't you just create a place to meet? And definitely don't ask permission, because the fact that you have to ask permission is the problem to begin with. Like, who has authority over where you live? Who can tell you that you can't do something? So he said, just create a place, don't ask permission, see what happens. So we did. It took $65. Okay, like I was saying before, city repair focuses on social capital, and that's what activates all the other like forms of capital or resources. So people just getting involved together, having ideas, saying, hey, I've got an old window in my garage, I've got some plywood, I've got some paint, I've got an idea. We start to activate the economic and natural capital. In this case, this thing that literally changed the social landscape of Portland began with only $65 in economic capital, and I know we have more than that in this room. But it basically activated what we already had. Like people said, I'll bring some pillows. You know, I'll just give them to the tea house. So the tea house started to run every Monday night. And it was all enclosed by doors and windows, and they all opened at once about midway through every Monday evening. People, like, there was about 25 people there at first, mostly neighbors, that were just hanging out. And over here at the base of the conifer, there was chai being served and bulk tea in infusers. And this was the inner temple, and there were all these subtle suggestions about transformation in this space once you went inside of it. This was called Grandmother's Porch. This was called the Shed. The different rooms all had these subtle suggestions of difference in the way that they were set up by 10 different groups of artists. So this was called Grandmother's Porch because it was talking about continuity and comfort and ancestors, all these pictures of people. This was called the Room of Love. and people tended to lay down and get very close to each other. There were pictures of people being loving, poems by E. Cummings and other people, a little boy sitting next to an elephant with his arm around him, that sort of thing. And so this was created by, actually by my sister. This was the room of freedom of expression with this great curving wall. There was an aquarium in it, and then the kitchen with all of these cups stacked up, hundreds and hundreds of cups that the neighbors had given over to share. And the sound would be projected into the rest of the tea house. And as you can see, the rooms are just kind of in there. There's no hard walls. The branches are penetrating through the roof. The rhododendrons and the trees are growing up through the floor. And one of the things that this was saying was, like, if you go to architecture school, you might hear that Louis Kahn said that architecture and nature are separate. So you have to express that separation. This was saying, Louis Kahn, you are full of it, and nature and humanity are one. Okay, so of course the city government came around because a realtor in the neighborhood noticed what we were doing, and after all, we are her crop. She makes money off of selling the houses in the Selwood neighborhood, even though she doesn't live there. And she was afraid that this thing would threaten her profits, the property values. So she was offended by it, and that was perfectly all right because Elk River had told us just get it started. So when the city inspector showed up. She walked up to the front door, and her mouth was hanging wide open. We knew she was going to come. We didn't know who it would be, but I recognized her. I knew that she was a feminist. She worked at a bookstore, and I also knew that she loved women. So she walked into the space, and she's like, okay, you know why I'm here, but I just got to say, this is the most beautiful place I've ever seen. And we said, well, you should really just have a seat. Like, what would you like, some chai or something? And she's like, you know, okay. She's just looking around completely wide-eyed. And what she didn't realize, like, I didn't point it out before, but it was a huge womb space. Like, the child that was in the diagram, we designed it to be a place so that when anybody walked into it, they would go like, whoa, I've been here before. And we were trying to make a place where people would feel safe and secure, like how they felt before they learned fear and prejudice and all these other acculturation layers. So she was sitting there, and I was there, and I said, well, welcome, Peggy, to the Moonday Tea House. And she's like, oh, Moonday Tea House, oh. I mean, because Moonday, of course, is very significant for women that that care about the goddess and revering the earth. So she had to leave and send a guy back to give us the... But actually, she's now involved in one of our next projects. What the city didn't realize is that we were ready for them. They said, you know, well, you've got to close this down. It can't exist. But the neighbors rose up and made a big stink, and then all the media converged on it. It was on the TV, and it was in the newspapers and stuff. And the city had to back off, like, oh, you know, and basically issue us a six-month permit. And they said, well, if this is going to be allowed to exist, you have to give us floor plans. We were totally ready for them. We created a manifesto that was all about beauty, and it was all about talking about colonialism and the absence of gathering places. Of course, it had the floor plans, the elevations, and the sections of the entire thing, which were really seriously hard to draw because there's not a right angle in the place, except for this old sort of cottage right next door where the grandmother's porch was. So we shot that into the city government as an antivirus. It went from bureau to bureau to bureau to bureau. They kept passing it around. They asked for more copies. We kept sending them more and more. And it began to affect the internal... like conversation of the city. I mean, if some people thought it was wacky and strange, but other people really, really understood it. I mean, after all, we are talking about Portland, and there's all these people in the city government that are really working doing their homework on themselves. So, but the tea house wasn't about the daytime. It was about the night. It was about a mystical experience where nobody's telling anybody what to think. There was no program. In fact, there was never even any like music scheduled. Just people would come in there and pick up the instruments and start talking to each other, sitting very close to each other in ways that they never would in a place where they were having to pay for a table or where, you know, things would come at a cost. We were saying time and space is not for sale, okay? And culture and community are not predicated on buying and selling things. So as you walked up to the tea house door, there was this little electric box filled with all of these little circuits and stuff. And inside was this head of this African goddess just kind of laughing and saying, ha, 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 the world is mine. Fact. Okay, so you'd come inside and it would all just kind of be glowing like this with over 100 candles, and everywhere would be saying, you're welcome, have a seat. One of the architects that came here was like, oh my God, this is the most powerful place that has ever been created in the world. He's like, this is more powerful than the Temple of Karnak. This is more powerful than the pyramids. He's like, oh my God, this is because all of those dominators were going in entirely the wrong direction. They were enslaving their whole culture just to build monuments to themselves. We call this great architecture, but he's like, all that you guys have done is just offer people a place to be. He's like, you know, but this is no more powerful than children just putting a blanket over a table and recreating womb space. It's just a little bit more sophisticated, but it's exactly the same urge. So woven into the garden, it was sitting there just glowing and stating the fact that nature and humanity are one integrated whole. Well, by the time the tea house was supposed to close, there were over 500 people a night coming to it from all over the neighborhood and around the city. People were coming from other cities to visit. But we in the neighborhood started to notice that children were interacting again outside. They were going to visit old ladies that then were making them lunch and stuff. And there was this kind of social culture rising that felt like, oh, where are we living in New Zealand or something? What is this, the 50s or something? Or the 40s? Or the 19th century? So like there was this, it seemed to be things kind of going in a different direction. Three families that had lived across from each other for a decade all went camping together. And we started to ask ourselves, what's happening? On the last night of the intersection, there were so many people at the tea house, they literally had to spill out into the yards all around this adjacent intersection, and then suddenly the gypsy caravan dancers showed up, and they put cones, we put cones out at the apertures to the intersection a block away in all four directions. And then the gypsy caravan started to dance in the street. We blocked off the traffic. And then we circled the dancers with all of these hundreds of people. And then when they were done dancing, they invited us all into the intersection, calling us back to the crossroads. And we all danced together. And what we didn't realize is that we had restated a primordial thing that had happened at the beginning of all human culture. Okay, well, the city government at the same time was wanting to see the end of the tea house. And so they came in and they said, you know, okay, you've got to get rid of this now. And we just laughed. We said, fine. We broke it into 10 pieces, the 10 separate tea rooms, and we sprinkled them around to 10 different neighborhoods throughout the city to seed 10 new tea houses. Okay, so like they've got war machines, and it's costing us all of our work and our time and our tax money, you know, to create all of this death. Well, we can also create peace machines. The tea house was a womb. It was a cocoon. You know what happens in cocoons? Things come out of cocoons. And as the city government thought that the tea house had come to an end, but was actually being sprinkled all over the place, what was really happening was that it had exploded, sent those 10 tea rooms around, and something emerged from inside of the cocoon, which I'll tell you about in a few minutes. In the meantime, the neighborhood was very focused. They started to hold workshops, and you can see, these are just folks. You know, Selwood neighborhood, like people talk about Selwood, and they're like, wow, you know, like Jack Kerouac used to live there. I mean, no wonder they're all a bunch of radicals. You know, but actually, like, they're just folks, they're just people, and there isn't there's no higher concentration of so-called progressives than are in this room, in that entire neighborhood. They're just folks. But we started to make these templates of intersections, and all these people were talking. Planners and architects in the neighborhood were saying, like, okay, well, the parents that came to these meetings were like, gosh, our children are having to cross busy streets. We've got 500 houses here. There's no parks. They have to cross busy streets. And our kids are getting hit by cars. Like, you know, let's do something. And then the planners were pointing out, well, okay, but you live in the colonial grid. I mean, you know, what are you going to do? Where are you going to buy the land? And then other people who were activists said, you know what, it's supposed to be a part of the infrastructure. Go visit the villages of our ancestors. It's the intersection node where the piazza is supposed to be. I mean, whether you're English and you call it a place, or you're German and you call it a Platz, or you're Italian and you call it a piazza, or you're French and you call it a place, or if you're a Greek and you call it a platea, those are all the place that occurs at the intersection. So the Selwood neighborhood started to get ideas. And they fanned out to just look at how the rest of the city was operating, and they started to look at what we're given for public places, and they're like, oh, great, a bench. Looking at a hedge and a parking lot and an Oregon luggage sign, how long can you do that? Okay, and then somebody else came back to the meeting, one of the planners, and he's like, you know what, Siena's got exactly the same population as the Selwood neighborhood, and they've got 38 outdoor gathering places compared to Selwood with none. And he's like, 10 times less the crime across the board. You know, you want to end domestic violence, let's start getting together as a culture. And then this 13-year-old young woman brought this in, this quote from Rem Koolhaas, and it said, Rem is quoted here saying, the architect is completely passive because his intelligence is only triggered by demands that he doesn't initiate himself. And other people there were like, God, that's true of all of us. He's like Joe said, like, I bake cinnamon rolls at Costco, and like, you guys never even get to eat any. He's like, and all these other people are like, God, I make shoes, you know, or I make boots, or I do plumbing, but I've never worked in my own neighborhood. And they all started to realize that all of their energy was directed elsewhere. Nobody was doing anything where they lived. And they were all sort of feeling helpless, like, God, what can we do? And the 13-year-old young woman said, whatever. So she just organized us to look at, like, what are the folks doing around this intersection? The tea house used to be right here. And she said, okay, let's not even talk about the stay-at-home moms and dads or the kids. Let's just talk about the breadwinners and what they're all doing elsewhere. Let's just look at who they are and how they might be working together. Like, there's a teacher and there's these students. Okay. There's an ironsmith. There's a carpenter. There's a contractor. There's an architect. There's another contractor. There's an electrician. There's a plumber. There's a landscaper. There's a roofer. Okay. Like, they could all be doing things together. There's a chef. There's definitely a lot of people who eat. There's a retiree who's sick. There's a doctor right next door, and they don't even know it. So we got pissed, and we started to add in all the stay-at-home folks, and we started to add in all of the kids, and this diagram became so dense that you couldn't even track it anymore. And we said, right there. So before we even decided what the intersection would look like, somebody got together with some kids, and they built a library on the corner. Like, the guts of community are all about the places where you go to get your stuff. It's about the cafe. It's about the meeting house. It's about the place where you go to get flowers or bread or whatever you do, you know, just to get your stuff. If you just put the stuff around the intersection of the village, then just by going there, you're building community automatically because you're seeing each other and you're interacting with each other. But rather than wait for a $15 million capital campaign, we just said, well, who's got a round piece of wood here, a piece of round wood? Who's got an old window and some plywood? Who's got some paint? Got together with some kids, in 2.5 hours they built the beginning of a library. Because after all, it's the social capital that matters. Build the relationships, everything else follows. So then we got together with an old cloth, a pump thermos, a honey bear, and some cups, some visqueen and some branches, and we built the 24-hour tea station. I mean, you can get gas 24 hours a day. You can go to 7-Eleven 24 hours a day. You can have tea in your neighborhood for 24 hours a day if you like. After all, every intersection has to have a watering hole. So before we took the intersection, we decided to call the Department of Transportation and ask them if it was all right if we took back the crossroads. And the person at the Department of Transportation said, what are you talking about? I mean, that's never been done before. And we said, actually, it happened all the time for thousands, maybe even millions of years in the places of our ancestors, but lately not in Portland, of course. And they're like, you know, what are you talking about? This is crazy. This can't happen. They said, you know, that's public space, so nobody can use it. And we said, okay, did you hear that? How about if you just like completely turn that inside out? And they're like, "Oh, you're going to get people. The politicians will get so mad at us." And we're like, "You know what? We're mad at you. We're mad at you right now." Okay, but fortunately, there were other people. Like, after all, we're talking about humanity. So there were other people in the conversation who knew what we were talking about and how important it was. And they realized that we were trying to address all the major livability objectives in the city of Portland all at once, with this integrated view having to do with economy and ecology and community. You know, we're not just talking about slowing traffic, which this does, and we're not just talking about making the streets safer, which this does, or helping people feel like the world is a better place, which this does. So those people in the department that were sympathetic said, okay, we're going to issue a permit to close the streets in all four directions to the next intersections. You'll have a few hours to work, but don't tell anyone that we did this. Okay, in a revolution, you start to see things like that. You start to find out, like, you know, you've been compartmentalized and isolated. You start to stand up and you find all these people that agree with you that you didn't know that were there. So, like, it's the fear that you have to overcome. So in the Selwood neighborhood, just like Elk River told us, here's this line. You step over it together. You see what happens. When you stand together, you keep making progress. So we stood up. We built all these things on the corners, this family-sized bench, this place for art and poetry, this kids' clubhouse wrapped around a tree over here, all these information and sharing things, the stage and the library was over here. So we painted the street. And it didn't actually look like this at first. It was much more simple and quick. The cops, the police came down, and they stopped, and they were like, they just kind of started to back up their car. But then they got out, and they're like, okay, what are you guys doing? And we showed him our block party permit, and he didn't even read it. He's like, okay, I don't even want to know about it. And he just backed away. Because he'd been coming to the tea house. And like, why that's important is because he had started to develop social capital. And I don't like to use those clinical terms, but because like a lot of the engagement that we're all going to be occupied in to build sustainable culture has to do with economic jargon, take the high road. Have the language, social capital, natural economic capital. So when we're not talking about socialism or communism or capitalism, we're talking about community and community economics. PDOT got involved the next day. They heard what we had done. The real estate agent reported us again. She's great. She's doing us all kinds of favors because, you know, we didn't want it to languish. We wanted to engage the discussion right away. Well, within a very short time, this project came to the attention of the city council, even though the Department of Transportation was trying to stop us from talking with the mayor and the city council. And the mayor and the city council took one look at this, and they realized that we had met all of these objectives and cost no money to anyone except ourselves. In fact, the whole thing cost like less than $200. But how can you ever build a sustainable place? How can you ever make the streets safer without a sense of place anyway? You know, how can you ever accomplish basic community objectives without a heart of the village? So that's what we had done. Within short order, the project called the Intersection Repair Ordinance, which enables every neighborhood in the city of Portland to convert an unlimited number of street intersections into public squares, was passed. And they told PDOT, don't you ever do that again. Don't you ever stop a community from advancing an initiative that makes the streets safer. Okay, so they were contra-dancing there on the right. It's all about the barn raising. Again, we're all familiar with that, the idea that we come out, we do something in common, it benefits all of us, we eat together, we dance, and then we do it again and again and again. Okay, so a lot of people involved, the kids' clubhouse is built. This is called the 24-hour produce station, toy station. Kids, we make it fun for kids to give away their toys. You know, they put the toys, the old bears and things, here in the cabinet, and then someone comes and takes somebody who doesn't have something. Adults put out produce from their gardens. Here's a bunch of sedum and fruit from the trees. That was built by some kids and an artist and a contractor in the neighborhood. So, you know, they took the space and they started to work together. So it turned out that we had some East Indian dancers in the neighborhood, and they came out and danced for the hood. A lot of people that hear about this project and come to visit, they're like, you know, you've just built it out of a bunch of old pieces of wood. I mean, it's really delicate. Like, why? First of all, why did you build it? I mean, it doesn't even look like the buildings around. The old Catholic woman on the southwest corner said, well, duh, there's a lot of trees around here, and it looks like the trees. And she's like, besides, we didn't have any money, because we don't have any money around here. So, but then another question they ask is like, well, what about all the vandalism? I mean, surely you must have vandals. And what we say is, well, we just kind of got them involved in the beginning of the project. These four boys, four different families, all built these tables and chairs together. They're their tables, you know. So not only do they not hurt the place, they protect the place. They talk about the place. They're proud of the place. And what this suggests sociologically is an entirely different view on our condition. Like, if kids are revolting against the alienation of their landscape, it's probably because something important is missing, not only physically, but in the fact that they are disengaged. They are disintegrated. So the kids' clubhouse becomes the Bombay Cafe. The real estate agent said, this all looks like a Bombay slum. So we said, oh, that's fine. Bombay Cafe. Tables in the streets, just like in a piazza, serving tea out of the side. This is another sort of amazing fact. This guy, Steve, who lives on this corner, he builds nuclear bombs. This guy, Brian, bomb parts, I should say. Brian here likes to build dragsters. They used to focus their stereo systems at each other during the summers and just try to kill each other with different kinds of music that they both mutually hated or something. So they were trying to drive each other crazy, but now because they're both involved and they've started to build a relationship, now you've got Brian over here mowing Steve's lawn. And it's not because Steve like intimidated it into him. This guy's the size of a Viking. Like, he started to care about everybody else around him. So after 9/11, the neighborhood decided to get a little patriotic. And you can see that they tried out a new idea. And it's not so much patriotic, really, but they said, okay, well, in the beginning, we painted a big field of green because we were trying to heal the landscape symbolically. Like, all this green on the corners, we were trying to say, the four divided corners of the earth shall be reunited in the meadow where the piazza always begins. And then as the real estate agent was complaining, they started to integrate her views. And then eventually she started to change her mind because she saw that the neighborhood cared. They started to integrate all of these thoughts about making it permanent. So they stamped the idea of the bricks onto the pavement with kitchen sponges. And then they painted the illusion of stone, where it's not a straight crosswalk, but a sort of a distorted crosswalk as you walk across the street. And then these are, of course, lines to slow down the cars. So they've tried out another idea here. This is the 24-hour information station where birth notices and garage sales and things like that are put up, and flowers are... This is the butterfly garden over here. There's the work party out doing stuff, repainting the street. And, you know, they're having so much fun that they go over here and then they paint this house. This is Anne Marie's house. Her house hadn't been painted since 1966. So the neighborhood just went over and painted her house. And that's just like little kind of evidence of how world peace can sort of recede by taking back place. We start to care. So, like Shakespeare talks about the stage, you know, we need the stage, and everyone's a player on the stage. But what if you don't have a stage? Maybe you won't meet your love. You know, so you need a place to meet your love. Permaculture gardens, winter gardens, full-on livelihood is being generated on the northwest corner where the tea house used to be, where all these gardens and greenhouses have been built. So from the beginning, the neighborhood's been taking the long view, and they've been saying, all right, well, let's do these weekly marketplaces out on the intersection, set up these tents, and do all this sharing and sort of selling of things, building local economy. They built a model showing how the little projects, they're basically sproutlets, like the library is a little library that gets bigger and bigger and bigger. So all the features on the corners start to become larger to grow over time with more and more infusion of interaction and giving. Okay, so from the beginning, they've been asking themselves, like, well, what does world peace look like anyway? I mean, is there ever going to be enough taxes? Like, will we ever be able to generate enough taxes for some politician to be able to say, okay, well, let's now focus on your neighborhoods and build a sustainable ecological sort of, you know, future where people will interact? No, world peace will never be constructed within the present political diagram, which at best represents some people. Like, it's only going to ever be built by us engaging each other right where we live, building our relationships and creating the landscape as a reflection. Now, one of the cool things about the intersection repair ordinance is that it mandates that the local culture that lives right around the space must have authority. It says that no permits are required or licenses required to build things on these corners in order to open the way and to facilitate the building of local culture. That's very cool, but what has happened here is it's the only place-based self-governance system in the entire city where people live right around the space that they oversee. So the vision they've created here is where they do indeed densify, except these are all passive solar buildings and they're no longer being victimized by developers. And the reality in the Selwood neighborhood is that the entire neighborhood, 500 houses, has decided that the four-block zone around this space shall no longer, like it's now law, no developer can come in here to change this. Only the local culture can change it. That's institutional change. Okay, well, what does world peace start to feel like? PDOT, the Department of Transportation, commissioned these surveys. 87% of the respondents say that they feel safer and there's less crime. 87% say that things have changed. 90% see that traffic speed has decreased. Like, this is a change of perception. This is an actual physical change that leads to this. Okay, well, on the southwest corner, on the southwest block, the people that live in this cooperative house just couldn't wait, and they just got started building world peace on their site, taking this 50 by 100 block site and turning it into a manifesto for all kinds of different gathering places and common spaces, whether it's their permaculture garden, their community piazza, their front porch, which is about solar collection, remaking the inside of the house, a new place for livelihood in their garage, a solar sanctuary made out of cob, a solar tree house for guests, a solar hot tub, a library, a sweat lodge. And they began by busting up the driveway to open up the ground for planting things and creating some urbanite to use for the foundation for the first piece that they were going to build. All kinds of water systems have been developed in the house now, reclaiming, gray water systems, basically water catchment for clothes washing and drinking, wrapping the old house, which didn't have very much character anyway, in cob, and then super insulating it, opening up the south face to bring in light, passive solar. And you can see that all kinds of things are going on here. Here's the solar tree house. Here's the Cobb sanctuary. This is just taking old vegetable oil barrels, catching rain off of the roof to water the garden. This is the Cobb sanctuary that they built in the backyard. What's really cool about this building, unlike a lot of Cobb buildings where the walls are solid and you lose heat slowly because you don't have thermal interference of insulation, these Cobb walls are hollow and they're filled with compacted straw. This column has hemp fiber in it as opposed to straw, because Joseph Kennedy, who was leading this workshop, wanted to try out using hemp chips. Okay, the roof has a pond liner on it. It's a living roof with sedum. The roof the roof cavity is insulated with old wool sweaters and socks. Has an earthen floor that's insulated with a layer of pumice underneath. There's all kinds of things to say about it, but it's capturing light from the sun, and it's a sacred sanctuary that the whole block gets to use. As you can see, it's the real thing. Okay, so the thing that came out of the tea house that was the big secret was the tea horse. We called it the tea horse because it moves. It was the kitchen of the tea house rebuilt onto the back of a truck. And our idea was, okay, we've got to take this idea out into the rest of the city. We can't just be this isolated island. We've got to do something. So we thought, what did the colonists do in the American Revolution? Well, they had a lot of tea parties. They didn't just dump tea into the Boston Harbor. They started to gather. Even though the British were closing down the commons and like, oh, you guys can't gather. You guys can't talk. You know, move along, separate. The colonists started to meet in basements and attics. They knocked down walls between their houses in order to have these large gatherings. They coordinated things so that at once they went out into the commons with forks, if necessary, to engage the British and take back the commons so that they could gather and put on the revolution. The tea horse is about basically creating gathering events throughout the gridscape, enabling a sense of place to develop so that people can gather and start to make relationships happen. So you can see, like, they're sitting underneath the wings because it does rain in Portland, but Persian rugs and pillows come out from inside the truck, and then it starts to serve tea and chai, and all these desserts are being brought by the people that are coming to see it as it goes from neighborhood to neighborhood. The tea horse is also called the tea horse because, like the Trojan horse, it's taking people where they're not supposed to go. Like, you know, you're supposed to go to a park for passive activities, maybe to walk your dog, and maybe you'll meet another person by walking up and saying, wow, nice dog, you know, and then start a conversation. The tea horse just drives right into the park, and then there's people waiting for it. They pop together the wings in about 20 minutes, and then they form a huge circle for about a minute so that people can make community announcements. And it's just to make the point, and it's definitely good for kids to see people being nice to each other. They're just making the point, you know, that, you know, we ought to have a chance to sort of let each other know what's happening in our lives. So somebody says, hey, it's my birthday, and then everyone sings them happy birthday. Or someone, you know, says, I'm getting married, or what have you. I'm having a garage sale, or I'm having a potluck. And so they can just kind of connect to each other. And then they kind of collapse into the truck, and there's this big party that goes on into the night. And the tea horse is basically made out of bamboo and reclaimed greenhouse plastic. And it costs $45 to build, aside from the cost of the used Toyota. Okay, again, just people working together with whatever they can contribute. Laurelhurst Park, tea horse creating this gathering event. You can see the candles are suspended from the wings, and it's starting to get dark. Here the tea horse has returned to its launch pad, the intersection repair. I forgot to say, the street is called Sherritt Street, and so we call it the Sherritt Square. The tea horse is returning to the Sherritt Square and basically creating cover. One of the chefs in the neighborhood who's always making food down at this ritzy club downtown said, you know what, I'm going to make food for the neighborhood tonight. They all just brought their chairs and tables out. They had enough chairs and tables, it turned out, by bringing them from their houses, and just sat down together and have dinner. Well, what the tea horse does in the overall is it goes around the city from park to park to park, to intersection to parking lot, just moving around the city in these huge loops that cross the river down the south, cross the river up north, cross the boundary of north and south, basically linking together the four quarters, making it into this kind of huge mandalic geometry. Part of why we're doing all of this beautiful stuff is because the city council was being pressured by some people not to approve the intersection repair. So we literally surrounded the city with all of these good things happening that were associated with the intersection. So when it was time to legalize this subversion of the grid, they were just like, oh, okay, it must be good. So we were going to a whole lot of work to get that one little piece legalized. Okay, so what happens is that at a certain point, once every 1.5 years, we link up all of those sites that the T-horse has been to, all those different neighborhoods, into a 6.2-mile loop of people holding hands called Hands Around Portland. So why would you do this? I mean, some people have criticized this project, actually saying, okay, this is a nice gesture. It makes you feel good for a minute, but maybe that obscures the fact that there's real problems in the world. I mean, what good is it? Okay, so what good is it to do something that doesn't create any garbage? What good is it to create something altogether that's non-commercial, doesn't cost any money? What good is it to stand in public space together and say that this is ours every now and then, to join hands, to meet new people, and then to go back with a renewed sense, you know, your batteries are charged up? Okay, well, that's all really great. I mean, it says whose streets definitely answers. These are our streets. In fact, right after this photo, they all walked onto the bridge, and they just stood there with the commissioner in charge of transportation standing with them, saying, this is the most important thing we could be doing right now. That all doesn't mean anything, though, compared to this. Hands Around Portland is about children, this little girl, joining hands with other human beings, and as far as she can see to the left or the right, seeing people being good to each other, actually being kind to each other and relating to each other, you know, so that when she goes home, she can shut off the TV because she knows the difference. Here in Northwest Portland, there was this group of 4 boys in a class called the Pursuit of Sustainability. And the class project was to do something that would help the Northwest community be more, Northwest neighborhood community be more sustainable. Immediately, these 4 boys came up with this idea to create a circular gathering place that cast shadows. And the teacher called City Repair, and we sent some people over there. I was there too. And the kids were talking about their idea, and this circle where people would create together over time, and it would cast shadows, and they'd know what time of the year it was, and they could relate themselves to the larger cosmos, and then they could tell, like, you know, when they could plant and things like that. And so we were like, okay, what's going on with these boys? And we looked up their surnames and traced them back to their origin, and we found that they had come from the area in and around Stonehenge. Circle makers by genetics. So we started to work with them just a little bit in order to take an idea to the Parks Bureau to propose, because this was going to be built in the park right next to Metropolitan Learning Center. So they came up with this beautiful idea. Like every great piece of architecture, it begins with a vision. And the vision went like this for those kids. And all sorts of girls got involved, and more kids in different classes, and City Repair was kind of organizing in the school. And they came up with this little myth story, which just goes like this. One day, the mother inside of the earth woke up and heard her children crying. They had lost their sense of who they were. So she rolls over in her sleep and she presses herself up against the surface of the planet to reveal to them the place where they could find themselves again, which of course is her womb. So here's the womb space, and this is sort of the sacred portal into the womb. This is the canal. And this is her hip and her leg. And then these are her breasts up here. And as you can see, sort of floating up here is her arm and her head. And it's as if she's just pressing herself up. This is the idea of the kids. So you can see this. Here, Father Son is casting a shadow through the sacred portal in to touch the seed of the planet in the center of the circle. They're talking about reuniting, creating a gesture that reunites the divine masculine and the feminine, which is, after all, what Stonehenge was all about. It's a great womb space. So there's her hip. Here's her breasts there. And the light's just coming right in from the father into the mother. The kids were like, well, you know, I mean, pagans, after all, weren't really alienated against their sexuality. Okay, the Parks Bureau immediately said no. We didn't tell them about that vision of the goddess inside of the earth, because they definitely couldn't have handled that. But we presented the idea, you know, of just creating a gathering place for the social culture in the neighborhood. And the kids presented this whole sort of tour de force of a historical view on urban planning that the Parks Bureau had never been familiar with. And the Parks Bureau said no. So what did the kids do? Here shows the kids out in the streets with their models and drawings, basically conducting class in the streets for adults to talk about their project. And then they're posting posters onto telephone poles to invite people to workshops. Basic community organizing. Then they went on to the radio, so thousands of people were hearing, and then thousands of people were participating by sending in, calling the Parks Bureau and sending in letters and stuff. And then the kids even went downtown with their models and drawings. Here's one of the office managers of the Parks Bureau signing the petition. The mayor and the city council signed the petition. The kids were actually, they called it Class Downtown. Eventually, the Parks Bureau. In the meantime, while the Parks Bureau had been saying no, basically for almost 3 years to these kids, they were very tenacious, and they kept organizing and organizing. They wouldn't give up because they knew that they were trying to save their own culture. And the people in charge were the last people with a vision. So they kept working on it, and eventually it became this fusion of nature and humanity with all these native plant leaves up on these huge stems, kind of reminiscent of Stonehenge. Parks Bureau eventually conceded and allowed them to build this place. This is the opening day where the kids are outside with a lot of people from the community and the school to see the opening of what was called the Baby Henge. Because they had discovered, as they were designing it, that Stonehenge was built over 1,500 years. So they were figuring that they were just getting it started. So you come in through this portal. This is the handicap access ramp. It's like coming into an archaeological dig with all these artifacts embedded in the stones. Of course, this is what it's all about. The kids tell time by the shadows that are cast onto the planets. And here's this sort of serpentine stone. And on the equinox, it casts a shadow right into the center onto this planet, the Earth. The four directions were celebrated here. Here's west. Supposedly, Americans are more afraid of public speaking than they are of death. But that's only because we don't know what it's like to actually be in the embrace of a community who knows who we are and embraces us and supports us. So this was all about communicating and sharing. That was very inspirational to a lot of homeless kids who started to get it into their head that they could do something too. So the whole point of city repair from the beginning has been to activate and reintegrate and reinvigorate the social culture in Portland as one place on the globe in the grid that's standing up and doing everything prototypically to inspire the rest of the family around the globe to contribute, not to be like the only one, obviously. These homeless kids basically got together because they were realizing that there's this condition where somebody's benefiting and somebody's paying the price. So what did they do? They built the Tea Pony. And their idea, of course, was take the tea horse and make a new version of it that was faster, better, stronger, all that stuff. And it literally is like better, stronger, faster than the tea horse. It works better, but it works much the same. Persian rugs and pillows, the kids from the street run it, it pops together, it's a way for them to basically practice the barn raising. It's so low tech that you only need to know how to tie your shoe in order to make the connections. And then they sit down, the kitchen opens up, they rotate turns, basically practicing service. People are bringing, you know, desserts and bags of Doritos or whatever to share, and the main point is just that they're giving. You know, don't worry about the fact that they're not eating organic food because they're not quite there yet. The main thing is to be together, first of all. So they sit down and they start to make art. And when they're doing this, the police don't come up and beat them or anything like that. And, you know, the police start to see that they're relating to each other as people. And this is the vision of the Tea Pony. Like, they're looking at the fact that competition is engineered into the society. I don't mean to, like, be dissing sports necessarily because they're good things. There's always cooperation at every level of competition, right? It's most of what's happening. But here the Tea Pony crew has said, well, after the game, the baseball game or the softball game where the two teams have been competing and the two schools have been competing, we're going to have the art department come out and set up, from both schools, set up these folding partitions and put out their art in the backstop. And then the bands from the two different schools will play. And then up at the top, the theater groups are playing the Tea Pony, setting up a sort of the catalyst, the social catalyst for it. And then the dads' clubs are out here barbecuing and stuff. And so it's this idea that, you know, you can be building culture as well as just like fighting with each other on the battlefield. So here's the Tea Pony. This is an incredibly strong canopy that's made out of mostly plexiglass, and it glows at night, but you can see the complex connections of the struts that hold up the huge fans. The intersection repair has been replicating itself. This is in the Sunnyside neighborhood. They've just finished painting it. Naturally, they've chosen the sunflower as their emblem. This is a more urban, much more urban condition than in Selwood. But what's happening here is that there's a master plan called Public Place Master Plan 2005. 96 neighborhoods, one intersection repair in each one by 2005. We're on track to do this. But I want to point out that, like, Siena, that place with 38 public squares, is the size of this neighborhood with 38 of them. So even though we get one in each neighborhood, that's just the start. Like, we have a long way to go. But we know if we even create, like 8 to 15 of these, they'll be happening in other cities. And as soon as we get 8 to 15 of them, they'll just start to happen. I mean, the commissioner in charge of transportation, former commissioner Charlie Hales, was saying to neighborhoods before he left, just take it, just paint it, just do it. Don't even ask us permission anymore. And he actually was saying, in Portland, the public places belong to the people now. He's not the mayor. He may end up being mayor, though. You know, again, about revolution, like there's people everywhere that want to help. They just need to start seeing that other people believe. Like we're building tree houses here. We're doing intersections here. The T-horse is out there. And basically we're surrounding the so-called leaders and bureaucrats with all kinds of like reinforcing stories that people keep hearing back from them about all the good things that are being done on a grassroots level, so they can't help but want to be a part of it, because after all, they want to keep getting elected. And at this point, the Department of Transportation is actually one of the strongest advocates of the intersection repair, so it's just taking off. I forgot to tell you, we're about to do 5 more of them in May, between May 9th and 18th, for the village building convergence, if you want to come be a part of that.